22. The Rag and Famish, and Hades Acres. Murdo stood outside his cabin next to his luggage and watched as the RMS Rome docked at Cockatoo Island. The island's quaint name was amusing, and a sign that he was no longer in London. "It used to be a prison island," a cabin boy said as he tagged Murdo's luggage. Parker. That was the boy's last name. "The docks were built by convicts. The prisoners have all been moved to some other jail, so don't you worry yourself about them dangerous types, sir. Only their bones and restless spirits have been left behind." Murdo tipped him, and soon after that, the porters arrived to carry away his luggage. He was glad to see the last of his cabin. It had been comfortable enough, but he was tired of feeling like a chicken in a coop. The rest of his party came out of their cabins, and Mr. Socrates guided them down the gangplank. Murdo was taken by Octavia's rather fetching green hat and green crinolined dress. Mrs. Finchley, too, had dressed up for the city. They had docked next to a British war steamer, Rosario, and as they walked along the boardwalk, Murdo studied it, impressed by its size and the guns aimed from its decks. He wondered what the sailors' lives would be like, with many of their years spent at sea. He'd stick with being a secret agent. He preferred solid ground under his feet. While Tharper monitored their luggage and equipment being unloaded, Mr. Socrates led the rest of them to a ferry. It transported them over calm waters, busy with smaller steamers and yachts. What would the streets of Sydney be like? Murdo wondered. Sheep and kangaroos stampeding around? They disembarked on the North Shore docks and climbed into one of the waiting carriages. Murdo sat beside Mr. Socrates, gawking out the window as they rolled along the pebbly streets of North Sydney. None of the buildings were as tall or as old as anything in London. How new everything looked, though very dusty. Maybe Sydney was more like New York before the Americans put up so many high buildings.
"Civilization at last," Mrs. Finchley said. "One more night on a boat and I would have thrown myself to the sharks."
"Our hearts would break with you gone," Octavia said. "And with whom would I be lucky enough to play cards?"
"Aren't you the kindest?"
Mrs. Finchley patted Octavia's shoulder. Murdo wished he'd thought of a compliment for Mrs. Finchley. She and Octavia were getting along famously. The carriage arrived at the front doors of the Rag and Famish Hotel, and everyone stepped out. Murdo gave the building the once-over, an oversized cottage with maybe 10 rooms, low trees growing behind it. 2 unshaved sailors stumbled out of the front doors, obviously drunk, even at midday. They paused to give both Octavia and Mrs. Finchley red-eyed stares, then staggered down the slate sidewalk. There were only ground-floor rooms, Murdo noted. If necessary, he could climb in and out of his room easily, but so could anyone else. In the lobby were travellers from several nations, Indians, Englishmen, and 4 French soldiers. Out of habit, Murdo scanned the room for an exit at the rear and gauged the windows as being large enough to jump through. They approached the main desk, which was also the bar.
"Are we really staying here, sir?"
Mrs. Finchley asked.
"Yes, Mrs. Finchley. I know it's below your standards, but you'll endure. The owner, Mr. Bullivant, is an old friend. Clever of him to name his establishment after Ensign Rag and Captain Famish, isn't it?"
"Who were they, father?"
Murdo asked.
"I'm surprised that you ask. They were imaginary characters that some artist invented. You seem to have an addiction to all that literary nonsense. The Rag is the flag, and Famish, well, that's what happens to all the ensigns on the sea. Bullivant doesn't think back fondly on his years in the Navy."
Mr. Socrates handed cash to the innkeeper and in return received 3 keys. He gave 1 to Murdo.
"I do hope you get your land legs back soon, son."
Murdo did feel wobbly. Keeping up the doctor face was exhausting him. He'd been too excited as they approached Sydney and had changed his body into this shape far too early.
"Steady as a rock, father," Murdo said.
After freshening up in their rooms, the 4 met in the pub and dined on boiled hen and potato. As they were finishing, Tharper arrived and nodded to Mr. Socrates. A message had been received. Mr. Socrates stood and raised his goblet of red wine. "A toast to the colonies." Murdo sipped his tea as Mr. Socrates continued. "I've been in London far too long.
One forgets the young energy of the colonies. It invigorates me.
You'll need a lot of invigorating, Octavia said.
Ah, Octavia, would you be referring to my age? Well, let me say, I feel young enough that we should all go for a jaunt.
He led them out of the hotel to a carriage. The driver was a flat-nosed man in a tan coat. Modo climbed up to the top bench and sat beside Tharpa, while Mr. Socrates and the women sat inside.
Where are we going? Modo asked.
Sahib is enjoying keeping this a secret.
Tharpa signalled to the driver for them to proceed, and they rumbled north through the streets until the houses grew sparse. Soon they were in the hills, farms on either side. But these farms were nothing like any Modo had seen from the train in England. They were vast tracts, with hundreds, perhaps thousands of sheep wandering across them. The road became a line of dust between the trees and hills. Modo could hear Mrs. Finchley complain from below. A half hour later they turned into a dusty lane, passing a sign that said Hades Acres. Someone had a sense of humour. They stopped near a brick farmhouse, and Modo followed Tharpa off the carriage, hopping the last few rungs of the ladder onto the ground. They were greeted by three tall, grim men in dusty leather greatcoats and tan slouch hats, each carrying a rifle. Their boots looked like something from the American West. They had no insignia, so Modo surmised they were militia. Their faces were stony, all business, when Mr. Socrates stepped out, but as the women emerged, the men puffed out their chests a little, and smiles appeared. One, a man in his mid-40s, stepped up and shook Mr. Socrates' hand. "Welcome back, sir," the man said. "It's a pleasure to see you again."
"Likewise, Clow. We haven't aged a day in 20 years. Is everything in order?
Your materials have arrived safely and are being unpacked as we speak. And she is here." The way he emphasized "she" caught Moda's attention. He'd almost spat the word. But Mr. Socrates didn't react in any perceptible way.
"Good. Good."
He turned to the group.
"Come along, you laggards. Your mounts await."
Mounts? Would they be climbing into saddles?
He'd never ridden and didn't relish having to learn how in front of all these men. And Octavia. Soon he'd have to change his shape. He could already feel his face drooping.
Fool! He'd forgotten to bring his mask.
He calculated how long it had been since they disembarked. He wouldn't have much more than half an hour before his body began to revert. He'd intended to walk with Octavia, but already one of the men was beside her, so Modo stayed a few steps behind. She laughed at something the man said, and Modo rolled his eyes. They carried on to the long, one-story brick house that looked as though it had been painted white about 100 years earlier. Behind it was a large wooden shed and an open area where several men were unloading Mr. Socrates' crates. Two of them used a pry bar on the lids. A lithe, big-shouldered woman with short, dark hair, dark skin, and a tan greatcoat stood in the middle of all the action.
"Not there, but over there," she shouted.
The men cringed. Modo could tell they weren't pleased to be taking orders from her. As Mr. Socrates approached, she turned to face him. Modo had to work hard to disguise his shock at her face. It was attractive, but her lips were tattooed in a dark blue, and swirling blue lines curled along her lower lip to her chin. Why would she permanently mark her face like that?
"Ah, boss, you've arrived," she said.
She was perhaps 40 years old.
"Good. You can tell these men how to unpack your precious swag. They don't like taking orders from a dingo."
"It's a pleasure to see you again, too, Elizabeth," Mr. Socrates said.
"It's Lizzie and you know it. You're only trying to get my goat."
She turned and snapped.
"You'd better watch that."
A man holding a wooden box jumped back and glowered at her.
"There's an altimeter in there. I bet you don't even know what that is, you worm. You break it and I'll break you."
"I like this woman," Octavia whispered to Modo. She was gazing with open admiration at Lizzie.
Modo, however, was a little taken aback and couldn't decide what he thought of Lizzie, and Mrs. Finchley couldn't hide her horror.
"Leave the men to their work," Mr. Socrates said, gesturing for the woman to walk with him back to the group. "I would like to introduce Elizabeth Thompson, or Lizzie, as she prefers."
Lizzie grabbed Modo's hand and squeezed so tightly that he thought his fingers would break. Her palms were rough with calluses. He looked at Mr. Socrates for guidance.
"You're Modo today," he said with a laugh. "Forget your life as Anthony Reed."
"I'm Modo," he said.
Lizzie let go of his hand, and he discreetly rubbed out the pain. He wished he could be Anthony Reed. He would miss calling Mr. Socrates father. Lizzie clapped Tharper on the back.
"Tharper, you duffer-dealing digger, it's good to set eyes on you again."
And without missing a beat, she bowed to Octavia and Mrs. Finchley.
"I can only imagine what you dainty ones think of me."
Mrs. Finchley turned red, but Octavia spat out,
"I'm not dainty. I'm Octavia."
"Yes, well," Mr. Socrates said, "I know you've all been wondering why we're here and what these crates contain." He pointed at what looked like a long red sheet that had been laid on the ground and folded several times. "All of these parts together will become an aeronautic balloon. Steam-powered, of course. Technically, that makes it an airship." He paused. "And our mutual friend Lizzie will be our pilot."